Coming up on Boston Public Radio, could the marathon bombings have been prevented? Did the FBI have information it failed to share with local police before the marathon? Congress asks, the FBI refuses to answer. One Massachusetts congressman, Bill Keating, won't take no for an answer. He'll join us. Are you socially awkward at job interviews or on a date? So what would help people communicate better with other people? A computer, of course, says one MIT guy. He'll tell us how.
Chris Lydon joins us. He ran for mayor himself. He'll handicap our mayoral marathon yesterday. Tell us who's got what it takes. Then Karen Miller previews her show with former Yahoo VP Seth Godin. He says our schools are failing completely to prepare kids for the new economy. All that up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Yeah, I woke up in the middle of the night, Marjorie, in a cold sweat. You know why?
Why?
Thought 11 mayoral candidates were coming in again today. By the way, we got great feedback on that. If you missed any of the interviews with the 11 of the 12 candidates for mayor, we did in one show yesterday. You go to WGBHnews.org, and you can listen to any and all of them.
Jim, what? Your questions were brilliant.
No, and yours were quite fine, too. Candidates were great to come on by.
In quite, any case, quite fine?
On a really serious notion here, could the marathon bombings have been prevented? Did the FBI have information it failed to share with local police before the marathon? What lessons can be learned to prevent a recurrence of the April 15th bombings? Congress has asked, but the FBI has refused to answer. One Massachusetts congressman, William Keating, won't take no for an answer. Bill Keating joins us now. Congressman Keating, thanks so much for your time.
Jim, I was listening in to you two, and I didn't want to interrupt this love fest going back and forth with the two of you. But
that's right.
You're worth the interruption, Bill Keating.
Congressman, you've been questioned a couple of times by Jim Browdy. It's, you know, it's an impressive situation, I'm sure. Anyway, you did write this letter to the new FBI director about the marathon bombings. Why did you write it, and what did you ask for?
What's happening following this issue, and I think people have followed it closely, we've had now three hearings in the Homeland Security Committee alone, and first time the FBI was invited to tell the public what transpired, because we want to protect Americans going forward. It's a simple and very important task, and we need information about what happened, the procedures, what went wrong, and things admittedly went wrong. The FBI said so publicly. And if we're going to do our job, we have to know exactly what procedures were there, what didn't work, how lapses occurred, and they did occur. So we started the hearings. The FBI declined that invitation. We had a second hearing. The FBI declined that invitation. And we had a third secured hearing in the event, as they mentioned, that anything they say could affect the trial. Well, it won't affect the trial with any pretrial publicity if it's in a secured setting, and they denied that invitation as well. So it's clear we're not getting the cooperation we need to do our job to make Americans safer. Now, what I tried to do is list in the letter some of the issues that are some of them that are really areas where there's a hole in the system and what we can do about it. One of them simply was, give me the dates that the Russians told me about, that they didn't receive information from the FBI when the so-called follow-up from the FBI went unanswered.
Well,
by Russia.
Bill Keating, let's stop there just for a second. You traveled to Russia after the marathon bombings, and one of the things they told you, from what I understand, is there was a March 4th, 2011 message sent from Russian intelligence to the FBI. The FBI has said, we responded to that. But when you were in Russia, the Russian intelligence people, I believe, told you, we know of no response from the FBI. So you asked for a copy of it, right?
I had the exact copy read to me by the Russians, a copy that has been withheld from me and other members of Congress by our own people. We've got, in effect, we got more information from, I did at least, from Russia than I did from our own FBI. Now, that March 11th letter, March 4th letter of 2011, was one that gave detailed information about Timurlen Tsarnaev. What happened in response to that, there was an interview by the FBI of Tamerlan Tsarnaev, and in June, they closed the case. Now, there's a procedural issue that has come back to haunt us, because as the letter had warned against, 9 months later, he did go to Russia. And as a result of the case being closed procedurally, there wasn't a red flag when that trip was, you know, came across officials. When he came back, there wasn't a red flag because the case was closed. There's obviously a problem in the way they handled this, and we want to correct it. The Russians vehemently denied getting any kind of follow-up letter to their response. So simply, I've asked the FBI, can you give me the exact dates and who you sent the letters to wanting more information so that they can take care of their own lapse, which is something that's important to us as well. There was a, because the case was closed, we had a situation where he was seeking citizenship. There would have been a background check, but because the case was closed, nothing was red flagged there. I went on and on in the letter detailing some of the troubles, including what Commissioner Ed Davis had testified in front of the Homeland Security Committee, that, you know, his concern that they weren't adequately informed of information at the local level. The FBI's response, I think you followed this, Jim, was that, well, there was information in the data bank. Well, what good is that information if local officials don't even know it's there? Why would they even be looking for it? So these are the kind of lapses and loopholes that we're trying to correct to make Americans safer going forward.
We're talking with Congressman William Keating, who traveled to Russia in June about the Tsarnaev case, and now has written a letter to the new FBI director asking for more information. You know, as a layperson, Congressman, this just seems incredible to me. The FBI refuses to show up for hearing after hearing. The FBI still hasn't told us the details of their investigation, or even told you the details of their investigation after the Russians first tipped them off about Tamerlan and about his mother as well. And here it is, months after the tragedy of the bombings. Who can make them talk? I mean, who has the power to say, you've got to come forward and detail exactly what you did and didn't do?
Well, that's why I think this letter is important, because it's something that's in writing. It's something that deserves an answer. And if it doesn't, perhaps there's a way Congress can take a step up and demand more. But they've been reluctant to do it, and you know, this, in effect, ignoring us in this situation, ignoring the efforts to make a system that's safer and more seamless, is just languished. Now, we also mentioned in the letter, because it was an April 22nd letter, 2013 letter that was sent, you know, that was read in part to me when I was in Russia, mentioning Ibrahim Todashev, the man that was killed in Florida. And I just want to find out the context of that from the FBI as well.
You know,
did the FBI request,
sorry,
you know, information on him? Did they have information they gave the FBI? These are important questions. If we're going to do our job going forward, that we have to have answers to. And, you know, in a several weeks, we're going to be, you know, we're going to be recognizing very soberly the anniversary of 9/11 once again. And these very issues, of lack of communication, of procedures that need repair, and jurisdictional issues in this whole homeland versus judiciary versus FBI, all those issues, part of the 9/11 Commission report said one of the problems we have is these jurisdictional fights and the lack of sharing of information among agencies. Here we are almost 12 years later, still dealing with these issues. After the tragedy in Boston, it's imperative that we go forward and at least have this information, because in my opinion, it undoubtedly will save American lives down the road.
You know, Bill Keating, just a couple of more quick things. We're talking to Congressman Bill Keating from it's the 9th CD now, isn't it? Okay, the 9th CD. As Marjorie said, and as Congressman Keating said, has written a letter to the FBI asking for information about their interactions with the Tsarnaevs. You know, you mentioned Ibrahim Todashev. What we know from the FBI from two brief press releases is they killed this guy right before they say he was about to sign a confession that he and the older Tsarnaev were responsible for the unsolved triple murder in Waltham on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. All they say is there was a violent confrontation. One report leak said I think he had a knife or a pole. Another said he was unarmed. There's no information. Were they also questioning him about the marathon, not just about the Waltham murders? And not only are they stonewalling and giving out no information, I'm sure you know, Congressman, when the Florida coroner was done with the autopsy on Todashev's body, the FBI ordered them not to release it. So it seems to me it's not just with the Homeland Security Committee and with you, there is this complete blackout from the FBI on anything related to Marathon Monday.
And these issues are very important. I think both of you might remember, when there's been law enforcement shootings in the past, there were times even in Boston when there were shootings that they called upon me as a out-of-district DA to investigate that and to go forward. And because the public deserves answers anytime a law enforcement official, assumes force. And that just really helps all law enforcement, I think, because it clears the air and puts the matters clearly in the public realm so they can understand exactly what happened, why it happened, was it justified. And these issues just won't go away and shouldn't go away. And one of the reasons I wanted to bring up Ibrahim Todashev is to find out exactly where the FBI has been going with this. Did they initiate the request to Russia for more information on him? Did Russia mention it to them? And these things are all important going forward as well. But in that instance, that's something that's independently important to be cleared up and to share with the public so that there's confidence on the use of force.
Bill Keating, last thing is when you came back from your trip to Russia, here's what you had to say, that top Russian counterintelligence officials told the delegation, quote, "If we had the level of information sharing that we do now, then the bombings might have been avoided." Do you entertain the notion that if everybody had done what they should have done pre-April 15th, that maybe April 15th would not have happened?
Yeah, I think there's no crystal ball, obviously,
sure.
And it's unfair to look back with any certainty. But you used the word, could it have? They used the word, may it have been avoided? And the fact is, there were red flags that were missed, and it is possible that may not have happened. Now, that's in the past. What's important is the future, because unfortunately in our country right now, there will be other attempts and there will be other attacks by homegrown terrorists or people from outside the country. And we have to have the most seamless system at our disposal to deal with that. And people will say and have testified, well, nothing is perfect. But that does not stop us from improving the situation we have. And, these things cannot be improved in the dark. We have to shed some light on this. We have to admit if a system wasn't working properly, and we have to change it. In that letter of March 2011 that was read to me, that I didn't see but was read to me, there was a reference to the fact that he was trying to he might be altering his name somewhere.
Yeah. This is Tamerlan Tsarnaev.
Yeah. Pakistan.
Yeah, and
yep.
He did alter his name
yep.
Slightly, and that caused a lapse. But can't we put in something? Can't we put something in place when we have information like that that just doesn't deal with the normal algorithms that look at slight differences in spelling?
Yeah.
And you put a red flag on that. We do not get many of these letters from other countries.
Carson, I want to be clear on something. What you're saying is that in order to compel the FBI to show up at these hearings, to share their information, we need Congress to vote on this? Or what do we need to
– Well, they've used two reasons for not coming to these hearings, the third – the three hearings we've had. And they've said in one sense, well, there's an ongoing criminal case.
Right.
Well, I know that. I was a district attorney. I know that you can't have to be careful with pretrial publicity. I know you can't tell things that are important to the, that affect the prosecution. We're not going to be asking those kind of questions.
But
we're
what
asking
do we,
about the process you use.
But
the
what
second,
do we need to change this, though? That's what I'm
if
trying to
If they continue
get at.
To stonewall
yes,
is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I'm not alone in this concern. In fact, as I've been, sharing this information with colleagues, there's a growing concern among members of Congress. And frankly, some of them are disappointed. They reached out for information in their capacities as chairs of committees. And they were told, for instance, that the March letter was just vague and wasn't detailed at all. And in direct contradiction to what I said. And that person finally got information and they realized it was quite detailed. And that, why was the FBI telling those people if the letter was of no significance? It wasn't detailed, when in fact it was. These are things that have made members of Congress, including myself, really concerned about getting a proper response so that we can move forward and make our country safer from these kind of attacks. That's our goal. And who could be against it? And the other issue they used is splitting hairs with bureaucratic, very flimsy bureaucratic jurisdictional claims that, well, this committee doesn't have authority over this. Well, we didn't have authority over Ed Davis.
And he came and testified anyway. Great point.
Yeah. Yeah.
It shouldn't make any difference. And these are the very things the 9/11 report cautioned against that we had to correct going forward. And here we are, almost 12 years later, talking about.
Hey, Congressman Bill Keating, we, at least two of us, are thrilled you wrote that letter and that you're on top of this. Stay in touch with us, and thanks so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Yeah, and I think, honestly, all the good law enforcement people in the FBI that worked so hard and did one of the best jobs you could ever imagine dealing with this as it occurred and moving forward, they deserve answers to this, too.
Amen. Thanks, Bill Keating.
We'll talk to you soon. Thank you very much, Congressman Keating. We have been speaking with U.S. Representative Bill Keating about what looks to me certainly like stonewalling by the FBI. I want to know what you think about this at 877-301-8970. That's 877-301-8970 or via email at bpr@wgbh.org. I just find this so annoying. I just want to...
Annoying. It's outrageous. Did you hear when... I wasn't aware, or maybe I wasn't, I forgot, when Bill Keating said two times FBI didn't show up nor answer questions about what their dealings with the older Tsarnaev prior to the Marathon bombings in public hearings of the Homeland Security Committee on which Bill Keating serves. I didn't know what he said, which is they were invited a third time to go to what Bill Keating called a secured hearing, meaning a closed-door hearing
yes.
where nothing goes to the public. They rejected that also. They have refused to disclose any information on the shooting and interviewing prior to shooting of Tamerlan Tsarnaev's friend in Orlando, who they allege was about to sign a confession admitting to a triple murder in Waltham on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Were they also talking to him about the marathon? Did Todashev know something about the marathon? And I have to say, the fact that Keating, he wouldn't use the, maybe he would, is outraged, is exactly what we need. We need public outrage. We need legislative outrage. Just tell the FBI, at minimum, if you're not going to tell the public what the answers are, tell the people we elect. So we can do something here. Our number is 877-301-8970. That's our number.
When he goes to Russia and says that the a top counterintelligence agent there told them that if we had this, if there had been better sharing of information, good communication, the bombing might never have happened. I mean, that is pretty horrifying stuff. And so you just get the sense that there's these turf battles. And I don't mean to
And no accountability. It's
well,
one,
no accountability. And you put this against the backdrop of what's going on in Boston every day with seeing the total and complete corruption of the FBI, not just recently, but in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, and 80s, and 90s in the Boston office. I mean, we're talking almost half a century of rogue agents and rogue bosses and just bribes and corruption, everything else. You say to yourself, what is going on with the Federal Bureau of Investigation that they can't come before Congress, even in a secured hearing, and tell them?
Well, let me add one more thing to this, by the way. In terms of the Todashev thing, you know the Civil Liberties Union requested that both the Massachusetts Attorney General, Martha Coakley, and her counterpart, I don't know if it's an attorney general, whatever it is in Florida, investigate, because in the room, maybe not at the moment, but as part of the interview process, there were two Massachusetts state troopers.
That's right.
And an Orlando local cop. Both Martha Coakley, we have a statement here which we'll read in a second.
I've got it
we
right
have
here. Yes.
Martha Coakley and we read in the Globe today, the Orlando, I think, head of the Commission of Justice or whatever it is, the Attorney General equivalent, said they wouldn't do it. What's Coakley's response?
Well, here's the statement from her spokesperson, Brad Puffer. Quote, "We have reviewed the letter from the ACLU. While the use of deadly force by law enforcement should be appropriately investigated, this particular incident happened in another state, which is outside our jurisdiction." Now, I am not a lawyer. But when there are two Massachusetts state troopers that are in that room mm-hmm. at the time that this man was shot to death and apparently shot multiple times, at least according to his family, I think there is some jurisdiction there because they're Massachusetts state troopers.
Well, especially when you're getting no information from the FBI.
Yeah.
If the FBI, and by the way, the Globe story that was written by Maria Sacchetti on this today, saying that Florida isn't doing it either, mentions that it's not unusual, or at least it's not aberrational, to have local law enforcement involved. She talks about a case from 2009 where the Michigan Attorney General and the Dearborn, Michigan police conducted their own investigation into a 2009 shooting of a Detroit imam by the FBI. So they can do it. Somebody's got to do something. Bill Keating is doing something. 877-301-8970. We both care a lot about it. Bill Keating does. Do you? Let's go to Jeff in Hyannis. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Jeff.
Hi. Great show. Great topic.
Thanks.
I do think that people are looking for information either too quickly on the criminal investigation of what went wrong here, and overall they're looking for information on international terrorism that really can't be disclosed.
Well, I don't think that's true at all, Jeff. With due respect, I certainly think we can have an explanation about what happened to Tartashev down in Orlando, Florida. You contrast that to this week with this terrible murder of Amy Lord in South Boston. Obviously, it's not international terrorism. But Ed Davis, the commissioner of the Boston Police Department, came forward and said, we screwed up when a detective did not follow through an investigation there. And needless to say, the Amy Lord murder investigation and the future of the defendant in this case, he's just been charged with her murder, is ongoing. So my dealings with government, it always comes down to the same thing. When they don't tell you the information you're asking for, it's always the same reason. They screwed up, too, and they don't want you to know about it, Jeff. I hate to be so cynical, but when they've done well, they're ready to tell you. When they haven't done well, you have to jump through a million hoops and pay money and file Freedom of Information Acts to find out what they're doing.
And Jeff, let's take it as narrowly as possible. The Russians say they sent a letter on March 4th of 2011 to U.S. intelligence about Tamerlan Tsarnaev. The FBI says we wrote them back. The Russians say they never wrote us back. They can't at least show that letter to Bill Keating in a private closed-door session so that Keating knows if, in fact, there was even a response? I mean, the part where I agree with Jeff, there's a line they can't cross. But they haven't even come close to that line yet, and that's what our concern is. But thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it.
It's like when they say, well, we can't discuss this because it's a personnel issue, or we can't discuss this because of confidentiality. They do that all the time in the state of Massachusetts. It drives me crazy. And it's not really confidentiality. They're not really trying to protect a member of the public. They're trying to protect their missteps. They're much happier about good news than they are about admitting their mistakes. Michael from Springfield, thank you for calling.
Yeah, how are you doing?
Great.
Fine.
Well, my thing is, after listening to the station, listening to the congressman, it's just like everything else that happens in the United States from 9/11. Nobody takes responsibility. The FBI, the CIA, from the bombings that we had in Boston. Everybody wants to move on and let's learn from our mistakes. Well, we got to stop and find out what our mistakes now and just get rid of some people. I mean, everybody in Boston that... the mayor, who didn't want the body of the bomber buried, which was quite silly, I thought, but who am I? But it all opened the door for people like to pick out who should be buried in whose cemetery. You know, it goes on and on and on. But my whole thing is just accept the responsibility.
Well, you know, Michael, when you're speaking, you know what I'm talking, when you said there's no responsibility, no accountability, my favorite example of that is, remember George Tenet was head of the CIA who was responsible for alerting the American people to the fact that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and we started a war. There were no weapons of mass destruction. And how was he held accountable? He got either, I don't know what it's called, the Presidential Medal of Freedom or something from George W. Bush for his wonderful work. Not only are no people held accountable for missteps in much of government, they're often celebrated for their missteps. So, Michael, I'm with you. We want accountability, and more importantly, we want information, as Keating said, so that going forward, we don't repeat the same mistakes. Michael, thank you very much for the call. I thought the best point that Keating made was this. If there was a failure pre-April 15th, mm-hmm. it was the failure of interagency communication, and he connected that to the single most important finding post 9/11 is the biggest problem there was the failure of interagency
exactly.
communication. And 12 years later, we're still fighting the same fight, and the FBI's response is silence. It's unbelievable.
It is sort of amazing that, you know, Barack Obama can't call them on the phone and say, show up. I mean, it's just, who are they? Who is the FBI to be operating in this way, kind of against the best interest of the, you know, the citizens of the United States? It just drives me nuts. Michael from Framingham. What do you think, Michael?
Well, I am amazed that every time we have a terrorist event come up, they come out and say, well, we need access to your phone calls, your email, your messages, what you're doing with whom, where, and all this other stuff without any restrictions so we can protect you. But they've had that for the past 6 years.
Yeah.
They blamed the lack of it for why 9/11 happened. And now 5-6 years later, or 10 years later, we get the bombing in Boston where they were actually warned by another country and they still don't have their crap together. The only law enforcement that I've seen in my lifetime that stepped up and did a remarkably impressive job was the Boston Police, State Police, and the City of Boston when they moved on this, took care of business, and got it done.
Yeah, well, closer to home, the local agencies, you know, it's often the case with everything in government, the closer they are to the ground, the closer.
But the critical issue is, did they have to, could we have prevented the underlying act, which wouldn't have necessitated them being put at risk, three people being killed, well, plus Sean Collier, four. So, Michael, thanks for the call. Part of the problem, I'll tell you why the FBI doesn't answer people like
Bill
Keating.
Because they screwed up.
No, because the public doesn't demand an answer. Bill Keating, I mean, think about this for a second. Is there any public outrage over the fact?
No.
We're all appalled correctly about what happened to 260 of our fellow citizens on April 15th. But there's a limited amount of outrage about what we don't know about what led up to April 15th.
I went to the League of Women Voters and spoke about lack of transparency in government. They all looked at me like I had two heads.
Yeah, well, hopefully Bill Keating and others can change. Let's take one or two quick more.
Let's go to David from Bridgewater. What do you think, David?
What else is new? The FBI is getting away with what they did with Whitey. What else is new?
No, it's perfect backdrop. You and Marjorie are right. That's true.
I know Marjorie's right because it's a shame. And you tell me the president can't tell them to give an answer? Please. What else is new?
Well, David, thanks for the call.
You know, that is what you wonder. I mean, why does it take some congressional action? You know,
well, that's their job. I mean, that's their job. But the assumption, naive assumption, people like me make is if a Homeland Security Committee says, which it wasn't Keating by himself, makes a request of the FBI, that the FBI might actually answer the questions
but
or at least show up to the hearing.
The thing is, I things happen behind the scenes. This is a new FBI director. He can wipe his hands of all this.
That's a wonderful point.
So why cannot Barack Obama or somebody else behind the scenes call up and say, get your rear ends down there, answer some questions? I mean, everything is not, you know, announced
right,
on the nightly
them.
News.
That's a good point.
So I don't see why he can't, probably because I don't know what he's doing. He's running around telling everybody why Obamacare is a good idea.
Did you see the great thing yesterday? John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, just as an aside, it was just a great moment, said, quote, if I had poll numbers as low as Barack Obama, I'd be running around the country rather than talking to us too. And a reporter whispered that the Wall Street Journal poll had Obama's approval at 48% and Boehner's approval at 18%. Exactly. In any case, we're going to stay on top of this because it matters a lot to us, and we hope it matters a lot to you.
Okay, up next, we're going to look at how a computer program can make people get over their social phobias. It'll help you with public speaking. It will help you with dating. It will help you with getting a job, we hope. If it's true, a machine can make you better at being a human being. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
On the next Radio Lab.
It's almost as if you've walked through a pinhole camera into the past.
Stories about trying to figure out what actually happened.
This is about truth.
You're imagining it because I've described it to you, but that's not the same thing.
And the pursuit of truth, properly considered, shouldn't stop short of insanity.
Hidden Truths. That's on the next Radio Lab.
Tonight at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Davis Mom and DeAugustine, PC, attorneys at law, knowing the lay of the land, not just the law, on the web at davismalm.com, DAVISMALM.com. And Skinner, presenting Asian art online through August 6th. The online-only auction offers a diverse selection of Chinese, Korean, and Japanese decorative arts, furnishings, and antiques. More info and online bidding at SkinnerInc.com.
A Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. So, how are your social skills? They need improvement? You nervous when you're about to make a speech or go to a job interview or strike up a conversation at a party? So, what would help people better communicate with other people? The answer, a computer, at least so according to one MIT researcher. He's with us, Ehsan Hawk. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Glad to be with you.
So tell us about this program, what it does, and what it's supposed to help people with.
Right. So it was designed to help people with social interaction.
Uh-huh.
So it contains a 3D character who can see you, can listen to you, and respond to you in real time just through a standard webcam. And for our study, we defined the interaction to be job interview. So the character plays the role of an interviewer,
uh-huh,
asks you a question, and at the end of the interview provides you feedback on what you just did in terms of a nonverbal behavior.
And you divided a bunch of, you don't call them guinea pigs, I do, human guinea pigs into three groups to see if this concept would work. Tell us what the results of that were, Ehsan.
Right. So let me tell you the experiment. So we divided the people into three groups. Number one is control, because they don't get an intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So all the participants, they're 90 MIT undergrad students, junior students, native speakers of English. They all came in.
Those MIT kids need a lot of help with social interactions. We know that.
I don't know about.
I was kidding, Ehsan. Go ahead.
Some of them do. We all do.
We all do. Exactly.
We all do. Exactly right.
I mean, look at how charming you are today. How much time have you spent in front of this woman, Mary, in this computer program before you came here today?
I did, but to program it, not to improve the interaction.
Okay, so the second group is comprised of who, Ehsan?
So they all came in and interacted with the MIT career counselor, and counselor would ask him question. And then we divided all the participants into three groups. One, control, so they wouldn't come back to the intervention. We just send them some YouTube videos recommended to us by the MIT career services as to what to do and what not to do in an interview. Second group would interact with Mary. But at the end,
Mary is our computer person,
the computer character. And then at the end, they would just watch their own video, because some people could argue that, hey, I don't need your feedback. I'm just going to watch my own video, and that's good enough for me. And the third group would interact with Mary, and at the end would also get the feedback. And all of them would come back and interact with the same career counselor from MIT. And then we take the videos from pre and post before the intervention and show it to other counselors at MIT who are not part of the experiment, who did not know anything about the study, and ask them to rate it.
And who did the best?
People who interacted with Mary and also got the feedback.
So essentially, what you were able to demonstrate is if you have any socially awkward tendencies, and as Marjorie said, all of us do, whether it's giving a speech or interacting with somebody we haven't met before, that a computer individual is proven to help people interact better with other people. Is that not the bottom line?
Well, I think if you need help with a social interaction, the best help you can get is from another human. That's the first thing you should do. Get help from another human. Mm-hmm. Get practice. Now, the motivation for this study came in because we went to this conference called Asperger Association of New England. We were demoing all this cool technology that can recognize expressions and all that stuff. Then some people came up to us and told us that, hey, I have difficulty making eye contact with people. Or once I start an interaction, I don't know when to stop. I need some help, but I fear the social stigma. So can you give me the technology so that I can practice at home? Nobody has to find out. I could do this as many times as I wish, and I drive the interaction on my own. So that was the motivation to be able to give technology which people could do on their own.
Well, you make a great point, though, in this piece I read about what you're doing over there at MIT, is that it's hard. Say you're talking to me and you're really doing horribly. I wouldn't want to say, God, you are awful. I wouldn't want to hurt your feelings. But a machine can be brutally frank. The computer can say, you really are awful. But what does the computer say? It doesn't say, you're horrible. I mean, how does it tell you brutally, frankly, that you're not doing so well without crushing your little ego?
Right. So let me tell you a story that we had the CEO of a major company who were visiting the lab, and I was trying the system. And then the CEO was using a lot of fillers, like, and I was like, oh, my God, the system is going to get all this information and show it to him, and he's going to get upset. But then when the system showed it to him, hey, you used the word basically four times in your interaction, he said, I like this because it's objective. It's not judging me. It's just telling me what I just did.
Remember when Caroline Kennedy ran for the United States Senate and she
I
said,
do.
You know.
131
you know.
Times in an interview with an anchor from New York One. 877.
And that was the end of her candidacy.
877-301-8970. We're talking to Ahsan Hawk, who's a researcher at MIT, who has developed a program that he thinks can help people who were, I guess you could say, awkward in certain social settings to perform a little better. You can interact with Mary, is that her name?
Right.
Mary, and why? Let's get down to this. Why have you not done it, Ahsan? I'm not saying you have any need, but all of us have a need. Why aren't you doing this?
Well, I do sometime. I do.
But you're hesitating a little bit. You seem to have
I already spend a lot of time debugging the system, so I just don't want to spend extra time.
But, you know, I want to do it. You know why?
Why?
All my life, I go like to cocktail parties or go to these events, and I start talking to people, and they walk away after about a minute and a half. And I can't – you know, people say, oh, ask them questions or engage them or something like that. I don't know what I'm doing wrong. I'm doing something wrong. Here I am on the radio, but I can't seem to function at a cocktail party.
Well, you should carry a microphone with you. You know, in all seriousness, I have a variation on that thing. If I start talking generally, they don't run away. I have an almost impossible time starting a conversation mm-hmm. in a setting like that. Would Mary be able to counsel me? What would she say? Give me an example of how you'd start a conversation with somebody you don't know. Is that how it would work?
So we didn't try that out, but imagine. I know I lived in 24th floor, and often I take the elevator. There's 30 seconds of awkward pause with this person.
Yes.
And I don't know how to start the interaction. So it's possible to use Mary to be able to help you break the ice. Right?
So whether it's job interviews, meeting somebody, going to a party, giving a speech, the kinds of things that ordinarily create nervousness, these are the kinds of things you think Mary could provide. Is this available to the general public, or is this just an intra-MIT thing as of now?
Well, it came out of my PhD thesis, mm-hmm. so I got my degree out of this. But if you want to make it public as a service to everyone, we need to do a bit more work to make sure it's sustainable and it doesn't require any service from me.
Okay, our number is 877-301-8971. If you can disclose to us, because we don't know who you are, we're not going to track you down. If there is a social fear you have, or whether it's a job interview or the kinds of things we've talked about, tell us about it. And also tell us if you can imagine a setting where you could speak to a computer, to Mary, this cyber woman, and allow Mary to critique your performance. And do you think there's a way, as Ahsan suggests, that it could improve your social behavior?
Yeah, public speaking is another thing, because so many people are absolutely petrified of getting up there. A good friend of mine, you know, he's in a cold sweat beforehand and just can't do it. I mean, if you could practice at home, I think it could be a whole new world for you.
Right.
In privacy, so you wouldn't be humiliated.
Right. I mean, you know the number one fear in America, right? It's public speaking.
Yeah, sure it is.
People would rather die than publicly speak.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know about dying first, but I mean,
dragged by wild horses.
You know what the old canard is about those things? You should imagine your whole audience naked. Have you ever heard that? I'm serious.
No,
that is one of the things like 20 years ago. That's
really?
What
is
they
that
would
what
teach
you do?
No, I don't, but I've tried it once or twice. And actually, Anthony Weiner taught me that. Now that I think about
good.
It. 877-301-8970. Fred Main, you're on with Ahsan Hawk, who did his PhD thesis on Mary, let's say. Hello, Fred. Welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie. It's clear that you really should admit that you've been using this program for 12 years because you've improved and suddenly you've come back on the air more popular than ever. So why don't you just admit it that you've been using a program?
Yeah.
And that's fine. And Jim, you still need it. But
Fred.
I think you've improved greatly. I use my wife for this. Her name's not Mary, but she just, I don't have a problem with public speaking except when to shut the hell up. And so she gives me the signal across the throat, like the cutting.
Oh, yeah.
And, that works. That works like a charm. Well, not really.
But Fred, isn't there a certain, I mean, I don't know how tight your relationship is with your wife, but wouldn't you rather get constructive criticism from a non-human source if it was effective?
No.
Then why not?
No.
Why?
No, because I'm a human person. I don't mind getting criticism. I've been married for 42 years, so guess what? I've already had this program.
Yeah.
And, but I know, I wouldn't mind talking to someone and asking for feedback, and I've done this in public speaking myself and socializing and consulting. I think it's very helpful to get some feedback. It is hard to accept criticism, but
it's hard to give it, too.
I think this program has some merit for that.
Yeah. Hey, Fred, thanks for the call. It's good to hear from you, as always.
Ask someone, do I look fat in this dress? And, of course, did anybody ever say you look horrible and you look fat? You look like the side of a house.
Mary
in a
will
dress.
Tell you
nobody's
to lose 12 pounds.
That. Exactly.
What kind of people need the program most, Aysan? What would you, if you had to describe categories of people, who are they?
I think everybody. Social interaction is the key to being successful at work or even at home. So anybody who needs to improve the social interaction could benefit from this.
And you know, there are a lot of people, just regular people, they don't have any kind of, they're not Asperger's or anything else. They just can't look you in the eye. You know, you've run into people like that,
it's
right?
They
look
huge.
Over your shoulder. They look somewhere else. And what's up with that?
It's just basic nervousness, is it not? I mean, it's a pretty intimate thing. You and I are looking at each other eye to eye. Now I have to because Marjorie just made that point. But it's a fairly intimate thing, which is daunting in certain circumstances, isn't it?
And also there are cultural differences, right? So I grew up in a different country.
Where'd you grow up?
Bangladesh.
Uh-huh.
And I was expected to, you know, when I talk to somebody who's older than me, if I look at their leg, as opposed to the face.
Is that really true, that you're not supposed to make eye-to-eye contact?
They think that I'm very obedient. I'm paying attention to
really?
Them.
Really?
So really respectful.
Oh,
wow.
That's very interesting.
So
actually.
Americans more big into eye-to-eye contact? Than
I think so.
Really?
Yeah. There are the cultural differences as well, so I wouldn't dig too much into it. But some people just have difficulty looking at the face and interpreting those what's going on. It's just too much for them.
Sometimes I think it's good to look at your mouth.
Aysan, you said a second ago that it's not quite ready for public exposure. What's left to be done to convince you and others that this is ready for prime time?
So I need to do some development, some testing work, which is not research, more of like development. So I'm looking for funding to get some more developers in so that we can make it available as a tool in the future.
Then you could sell it and become wealthy, right?
Well, for now, I'm interested to get more data and do the research.
Okay. It's not about the money. Tell her that. John, you're in Boston. You're on the Aysan Hawk, who's developed this very interesting program. Hey, John.
Hi, John.
How are you today?
Great.
Good.
I was wondering if he envisioned it at all on a B2B application for cold calling or prospecting for businesses.
Ooh,
that's brilliant.
Yeah.
One of the hardest things in the world is a cold call. How about that, Aysan?
Absolutely. I mean, I do a lot of Skype calls. When there are multiple people, I don't get to see what I'm talking. If there is a way to get some feedback as I'm talking.
So you could do this with Mary?
We could do this with Mary. I mean, the technology is built. The applications are endless at this point.
John, thank you for the call.
So people should stay tuned to what? To find out when this is going to be out there and available. Go to the MIT News? You're going to have an announcement? Or how do people find out if they're interested?
So for my website, there is a link that says you can sign up for if you want to be updated about it.
What's your website?
It's a web.com. It's a long website.
we can do. Can we link to this?
Through, yes.
Yeah.
Before you
leave, if you go to the WGBHnews.org site, we will link to Aysan's site. Now, this is actually quite great because the more I think about it, the more we've been talking, the more I agree with your point. It doesn't matter how skillful you are in social settings. There is always one kind of social setting where virtually everybody is uncomfortable and just can't pull it off. And the notion, well, how'd
there
you
are
decide,
many social settings.
There are. How'd you decide the name and the face of this person, this non-person? How'd you decide on Mary?
So Mary's the name of the character and the system that we built.
Well, why'd you decide to call her Mary?
It's an arbitrary name.
Okay, fine.
She's also very cute. I mean, I think you would like looking at her, man or woman. She's very attractive. She's sort of she's not anything. You wouldn't say she was white. You wouldn't say she was Asian. You wouldn't say she was Indian. She's just sort of a combo.
It was done in a purpose to make her look a bit ambiguous.
Yeah, she does look ambiguous, but she's very attractive.
And we have gone through a lot of iterations to make it look. I mean, she's still clunky. She still needs a lot more work. But we have gone through a lot of iterations to get to where we are today.
Aysan, one last thing from me. Let's assume one of the problems that somebody has is their, you know, first date kinds of things. If someone were to ask Mary out, what does Mary say? If they say, Mary, are you free Friday nights at 7:30? What will she say back to you?
Well, we are planning to do a study on speed dating. So we want people to come in and interact with Mary and then try out a real speed dating scenario and see whether they're being successful in picking up the person.
Great.
So
Aysan Hawk, this is great. Good luck with this. We're dying to hear
much time.
The results.
You could fall in love with Mary, and then it would be a real problem.
Aysan, thanks for being here. Really appreciate it.
Aysan is the man behind the automated conversation coach. In the fall, he'll be joining the University of Rochester as an assistant professor of computer science. Thanks for joining us. And we will post information on our website so you can find out how to get this great piece of technology. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Okay. In the 20th century, going to camp was very simple. You had a bunk bed, you had a cabin, you had to clean it up. Maybe you had a couple of swims in the lake or did some hiking. Now it's out of control. Zombies, helicopter parents, and cell phone decoys. How the simple summer is getting decked out. Camping, up next on Boston Public Radio.
Hi, it's Jim Browdy from Boston Public Radio. Okay, picture this. 20 of Boston's top chefs all in one place cooking up some culinary magic from the best local ingredients paired with a perfect wine, all part of a vibrant and elegant evening on the town. That's why I'm inviting you to the Chef's Gala reception at the Taste of WGBH Food and Wine Festival. It's Thursday, September 19th at our studios in Brighton. Visit wgbh.org/festival for more. Hope to see you there.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And Tanglewood, presenting Yo-Yo Ma with the BSO, led by Charles Dutoit in music by Dvorak and Stravinsky, Sunday, August 4th. More information available online at tanglewood.org. And the members of the WGBH Sustainer Program, whose gifts of $5, $10, or $20 a month make up the most reliable income for the programs you love on 89.7. Learn more about sustaining membership at wgbh.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Okay, so you send the little darlings off to overnight camp. The camp says your kids will have fun and build relationships. We've all had this experience. One relationship you may want to continue, though, is with you. But the camp says, uh-uh, no cell phones, no iPads. Your kid's going to be unplugged for, say, 2 weeks. So we have a couple of questions for you at 877-301-8970 in the midst of the summer camp season. Could you make it through the summer without texting or calling your kid?
Yes.
And could your kids survive a summer without being plugged in? 877-301-8970. You know, the American Camp Association, or whatever the trade group is, says the growing majority of summer camps don't allow kids to bring cell phones and that sort of thing. Tell the story, though, of what some parents do to get around the prohibition at certain camps.
Well,
this is unbelievable.
They have a decoy phone. So what they do is they send the kid up with the regular phone, which the camp says will hold for you until camp is over. And then the kid stashes the decoy phone so they can text their parents surreptitiously. But of course, what happens is the kid gets outed because the parent will call the camp and say, so-and-so, Johnny or Susie is having a problem, and they'll say, how do you know? And then Susie or Johnny will have to confess that they texted mom and dad. The stories are fascinating, though. They say that the people that are having the most problem with this, surprise, 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 are the parents, because parents now are so used to being able to reach their kids immediately via cell phone or texting. I view it as a great vacation for everybody.
Well, because they're in a safe environment.
Yeah,
I totally agree with
you.
Yeah,
I love it. And you know, lots of us have had kids in camp. I've had kids in camp. When there's some crisis, the camp will call you. But it's great to be – and the other thing is, as these stories say, you're not really having the camp experience if you're sitting on your bunk bed texting to all your friends. You're just not.
The thing you just described, though, the decline of Western civilization could not be better described than a parent arming their child with a decoy phone. Johnny, you take two phones with you. They'll confiscate phone A, and you'll apologize, and then you text me on phone B. How pathetic is that?
Listen, you know how I feel about this. I think parents are so over-involved in their kids' lives. It's just unbelievable. You feel like you have to be, you know, giving them advice on their term papers in college. I mean, they are in college.
You don't?
No, I don't.
I thought you had to write them. 877. Okay, I've now been corrected. 877-301 8970. So you've either you're just out of the summer camp era yourself, you're a young 20-something, or you're a parent who sent your kids just recently, or maybe now, or maybe in the recent past, and it is a totally different, not only are the camps different, but this we went to camp when there were no such things as cell phones and all these electronics. I had a little transistor radio when I was in camp,
and
which
you,
was fine.
You were what, Jim, when you what? Were at camp?
What?
You were the most improved camper.
I was no. I'll tell the story briefly
because
it's humiliating. No, it's one thing. I was most improved camper at Camp Onabar, which is Rubino backwards. But the humiliating part was not most improved camper. I was most improved camper, as Marty said, 2 years in a row. And you have to imagine where you have to start to be most improved. It's totally true. 877-301-8970.
You know what they don't address in these stories?
What's
iPods.
That?
Lots of kids, especially teenagers, have iPods.
No, but they do. They say that anything that is electronic in any fashion, most of these camps preclude
you
from
having.
Oh,
I think a lot of the camps allow the iPods.
They do?
They just don't allow you to have the texting and the cell phones and the computers.
But that's garbage, too, as you said. So you sit in your bed with your earplugs, and the whole point of
it's
camp beyond fun.
Night. It's to go to sleep at night.
Well, not only, no, it's also to like actually relate to another human being. Mm-hmm. Have fun. No, it's not.
No, but I'm saying a lot of camps that will forbid the other stuff will allow iPods.
Well,
that
Let's
has been
take
my
some
experience,
calls.
Jim, as a camp mother.
Jake, you're on the road. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Jake.
Hi, how's it going? Thank you very much for taking my call.
Pleasure.
It's great to hear all the exciting conversations you have on this radio station. I listen to it everywhere I go.
Oh,
terrific.
Thank
We're
you
very
much.
Happy to hear that. What's up, Jake?
Yeah, I'm kind of radical on this notion because I simply do not watch television. This is how I keep up on the news. But this is an issue that touches very close to my heart. I traveled the country, you know, just when I got out of high school, I just decided to take off and leave and have no technology in my life. I just went ahead and did it. And to answer the issue and the question is, I think it's extremely important to show our children what the world is like without technology.
I agree.
Forever onward, before, you know, the internet came out and all these things just started popping and popping and popping and the increasing, you know, intensity of them. You know, now our children have no idea. They have no notion of a world without technology.
I know.
And so I think it's so important that we should have classes in high schools and in, you know, elementary schools just to show them a world in which they've never even experienced. You know, so I do think that this, you know, whole camping thing of just getting them, you know, 2 weeks without, you know, technology is a good thing, but I think that's just like, you know, the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, but it's a good tip to start with. Hey, Jake, you have a lot of passion in your voice. That was a great call. Thank you for making it. 877-301-8970 to get you into the camp mood.
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard of Heavyweights?
Oh, the movie.
It was a movie about overweight kids.
Yeah.
Here's Ben Stiller, who I love, by the way. He plays a fitness guru camp counselor. Listen to what he has to say.
Attention campers, lunch has been canceled today due to lack of hustle. Deal with it.
You know, whenever I hear, I laugh even just thinking of Ben Stiller. I love him. Let's go to Kitty in Rhode Island. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Kitty.
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I am a 13-year-old Girl Scout leader, and I was a Girl Scout. Girl Scout camps have never allowed kids to bring in technology of any kind.
Great.
And the girls make a fuss at first, but then all of them say that they really appreciated not having the technology. And I can tell you two reasons. They start to use their problem solving skills and it forces them to make new friends. They are not allowed to isolate themselves thinking that they'll be able to text their friends later. And I saw this with my daughter when we moved to a new town. She didn't make friends. And I found out that she was basically had her old friend group online. So there was really no reason for her to have to make friends. And after we kind of cut that cord, she made a whole new group of friends. And I noticed that in a segment the day you mentioned that in Silicon Valley they do not have the technology in the high schools where all these CEOs of Google.
Karen Miller, who's going to join us in about an hour, said that. Yeah.
It's very telling there because kids don't use their problem solving technology. They isolate themselves alone together. There you go.
Hey, Kitty, before you go away, you say it's tough for them at first, but ultimately they get over it. What is that initial period like?
It's whining. You know, like any kid who doesn't have the thing that they want.
Yeah.
And you can deflect it with a lot of different ways. Humor, you know, usually works. You know, I promise you won't die without your iPad. And I work on a farm, and the farm tours that I gave last year, it's really funny because there are a lot of people who are very disconnected from their food. And I give farm tours, school tours. And I always say to the kids, could you live without your iPod? And they all say, no. could you live without your texting? No, no. And I say, okay, how long do you think you could live without food? And they kind of look at me and I say, you think you can't live without that thing in your hand? You, believe it or not, you can. I mean, it'll be really hard and you'll have a little bit of DTs and a little bit of anxiety, but you really can survive without that electronic thing. You really can't survive for more than a few days without food. And
hey,
it just boggles the mind when the light clicks and they're like, oh, my gosh.
Hey, Kitty, the Girl Scouts are lucky to have you. Thanks so
yeah,
much for
the call. Yeah, what a
great
scout leader. You know what else, too? It's liberating for parents because the way it is now, as everybody knows, your kid forgets something at school. Your kid forgets something at camp. They're texting you right away. I need X, Y, and Z. At camp, they have to write you a letter and say they need X, Y, and Z.
Well, you're a big letter writing fan, too. I just realized that's part of your motivation. You are totally into the old school. You write letters.
I do.
Thank
I do.
You notes
I do write
sort of
letters.
Thing.
Yeah, and it's fun to write. Although I must admit, as my kids have gotten older, you know, they don't miss me as much, so I don't need to write as many letters. I used to write one almost every day, but now I don't do that anymore. But that's the thing. They can't get that instant gratification of mommy do this, mommy do that, mommy I forgot.
You wrote
this,
a letter to most
that.
Of your kids. They'd hold up and say, "What is this? What are these things on the page?"
They complain they can't read my writing. They ask me to type it on the computer. Alan from Plastow, New Hampshire. Hi, Alan. What do you think?
I think that people need to learn to live without this technology. There's no, we don't do Facebook or MySpace. I have a son who's getting a second degree at college. He does not have a cell phone. He does not want one because people are calling you when you're studying for things. I have a prepaid cell phone that only my youngest one's school has the number to. My son has it, too, because if that phone rings, I know I have to answer it. It's an emergency.
Wow.
You know, people are just ridiculous. And I was telling the young man who screens things, I was visiting a rehab facility, and I was amazed. And one of the big rules is no electronics in rehabs because these people need to get away from their addictions.
Mm-hmm.
And during the visits, I noticed parents were sneaking their cell phones over to their kids. And their kids who were allowed to go outside, like on pathways during visitation times, and they were calling people. Now, are you not enabling your kid to continue to possibly
yes, you
be
are.
Calling their dealer?
Yes. Well, you're doing a lot of bad things, including not following the rules. Ellen, good call. Thank you so much. Boy, talk about discipline from the Girl Scout leader, Dale. I mean, this is a whole different world from what I'm used to. Gabe, you're in Milford. You're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about essentially unplugged summer camps for your kids. Hi, Gabe.
Hi, how you doing?
Excellent.
I'm a 21-year-old Eagle Scout, so I'm just past the cutoff for when I used to go to summer camps.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that not having a cell phone was very liberating.
Why?
But you start to really interact with the people around you more, and especially I noticed that when I would forget things, you know, as a teenager would do. I just had to go without it for a few weeks and everything. Like, there was one time I just forgot underwear, and I just went without it.
It's happened to me many a time, Gabe, let me tell you.
Yeah,
they're overrated.
Yeah, you just learn to deal with it.
But, Gabe, before you went to camp, you're 21 years old, so you're not, as you say, far removed. Were you pretty much wired pre-camp, and then you gave it all up, or you're not that into it any time?
I was pretty much wired.
Oh, you were? Good. Well, that's great.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I still enjoy it, but I'm able to deal with it. And actually, one time, the only occasion when I was allowed to bring a cell phone, and I did it, was on a trip that I did that was hiking in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
I put it in my backpack, and the week after we got back, because it was a week-long backpacking trip, the thing was fried anyway. So that's just karma. I learned my lesson.
Hey, Gabe, great call. Thank you so much for your call.
I thought you told me phones won't get overheated in the car.
They don't get overheated in the car.
He just said his phone was fried.
Well, he was doing some camping thing or some hiking. I mean, he's doing something. It's not the same as leaving it in your car in the garage Guest Street in Brighton, Marjorie.
Jill from Rhode Island, what do you think about giving up your high-tech, your computer, your phone, et cetera, at camp?
I am all for it. I have a young teenage son who goes away to camp on two separate occasions during the summer. For both camps, he has to surrender his phone. He leaves it with us. And his first experience a couple of years ago, he came home and he said to me, "Mom, every day was like Christmas." He was
really
thrilled. He was attached. And, you know, they learn, as you've already kind of alluded to, at camp in context. And so if they're not taking in all of the different opportunities that are available to them because they're sitting in their bunk and they're texting their friend or they're calling their friend, then they're missing out on those opportunities. And that really isn't the point of the camp.
Amen.
The camp.
Well, also, and you were okay with it? I mean, part of the, as Marjorie said at the beginning of this discussion, most of the literature on this says that it isn't the kid who has the hardest time. The hardest time is for the parent who can't communicate with their child. You didn't have a problem, obviously.
No, because if something happens, some responsible adult, right. whoever is right. responsible, is going to contact me or my husband. We need to trust the adults that are in charge, and I do. And he was fine with it too. And let me just throw in, I love your show.
Thanks,
incredible
Jill.
Guests, incredible speakers.
You're terrific.
Thank you very much.
You know, I was thinking of the liberation of summer camp. When you sent your first kid to summer camp, once you got over the anxiety, I was talking to a woman the other day who you know, I just won't mention her name on the air, who has a 2-year-old kid. And she said to me, how old is
That's
your
a
kid?
Little young for camp.
She said it's her first kid. She said, how old does the kid have to be before I can send him to summer camp? It is. I mean, if you can deal with the separation anxiety thing,
yeah.
When the kid's away for 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 8 weeks, it is unbelievable.
Well, you know what the thing is, like I said before, that you sometimes feel guilty as a parent.
Sure.
If you're not,
totally.
If you're not anxious about them being away from summer camp, or if you're not going to, never mind every single athletic event, but, you know, some parents, I know, they go to the practices as well. You know, it's kind of crazy. We've just amped up the expectations so much. God, you know, I don't know. I don't know how that.
By the way, the story that Marjorie has told a number of my friends, I want to dispel right now. She has said that when I first went to summer camp, my mother changed our home phone number. That is, there's no truth.
There's no
truth to that rumor.
That's not true. I know what happened.
What's that?
She changed the locks.
So that's our summer camp discussion. Thanks so much for being part of it. What's up next, Marjorie?
That is our summer camp. Up next, we have Open Mic with Christopher Lydon. Yesterday, we talked to 11 of 12 mayoral candidates. You heard them here yesterday between noon and 3. Christopher Lydon, who ran for mayor himself, he's going to give us his take on this crop of aspiring mayors. So keep your dial with us, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Well, can you multitask?
The tragic irony of the 21st century is the people who most frequently multitask are least able to multitask.
I'm Kara Miller. This week on Innovation Hub, we look at the price we're paying when we respond to every email, tweet, and text. Tonight at 9 here on WGBH Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and DeCordova Sculpture Park and Museum in Lincoln, Mass. 30 acres of contemporary art set in an idyllic outdoor landscape. Plus, constantly changing exhibitions in the galleries. Open every day this summer. DeCordova.org. And Bentley, knowing that when guided by ethics, enriched through arts and sciences, and refined with real-world experience, a business education can prepare you for a career and life that leads anywhere you choose. Bentley, the business university.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy, and she is Marjorie Egan. Yesterday, we ran a mayoral marathon. 11 of the 12 candidates joined us. And by the way, if you missed it, you can hear them all on WGBHnews.org. So we wanted some feedback, some analysis of what they said and what they didn't. You can give it to us at 877-301-8970. And then we said, maybe we can find a former candidate for mayor to weigh in as well. We found one. He joins us every Thursday on Open Mic. He would be Christopher Lydon. Hey there, Chris.
Not the people's choice, exactly. 20
it was
years
close,
ago,
though. It was close.
It was very, very close. Very close. And there is a way to count it that I won.
How was that way?
Well, haven't I told you this? I mean,
let's hear it.
It is a hack race, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and there were the, you know, Menino had the Flynn hacks, the city hacks. Brett had the Bulger hacks, the state hacks. You know, the sheriff, of course, had the county hacks. Bruce Bowling had the black hacks. Rosario Salerno had the women hacks. And then there was me. And you know,
were you hack-free or did you have
I was totally
hacks?
Hack-free.
That's why you lost.
There were no Lydon hacks. I wasn't promising anybody a job. Nobody. No identity politics. Anyway, but I just want to say first, I was on the edge of my seat for 3 hours yesterday. I thought you guys did a wonderful job.
Thanks.
Quite seriously. But then I have to say, when it was over, I wondered who scripted this campaign. I mean, nice, respectable, all well-spoken, decent, no embarrassments here, no raging racists or anything else for that matter. But they don't say almost anything. And they don't disagree on anything significant. And I also felt there was a terrific, I mean, the main thing I feel about the race is there's no, where are the people? Where's the energy? Where's the, I mean, 2 years ago, the world was in an uproar about Occupy. Where is the 99% candidate yesterday? Where was even the voice of somebody saying, wait a sec, yes, Boston is a banquet, but most poor suckers are starving. Not most, but an awful lot are starving for city services, for the things people need in a modern community. And I thought something's missing here.
There was a lot of caution. I mean, let's say there was a lot of caution. I don't even mean this as a criticism. I mean it as an observation. I think one theme that went through most but not all of the interviews is everybody was being careful. Did you not think that was
absolutely
the case?
Much too careful. John Conley was kidding you, I think, when he said he likes the open field. We would have had a better race. He would have had a better shot if Tom Menino had run for a umpteenth term.
Against him.
And the larger case about Meninoism had been drawn. And I don't mean in a vicious or even a personal or vindictive way, but let's get the other side of the story. This is a totally, you know, little children of Menino race. They're all doing the Menino thing. And what is the Menino thing? The Menino thing is don't ask. I'll do what I can for your sidewalks and this, but don't ask. And
can I stop you right there for a second? There's one interesting thing about it. I think this is where you're going, is there is great, not only was Connolly the only one who had challenged Menino when it was unclear that Menino was not, we didn't know if he was running or not, we thought he probably was, but he is also the only one yesterday, I thought, who overtly was willing to lay some blame at Menino's doorstep. We were talking to him about the school system, and I think he was talking about the managers, Court Street, and how horrible they were.
Right.
I asked him a question and listened to his answer. Here it is. If they're incompetent and we have an appointed school committee, so should the incompetence of those staffers you're talking about, should that be visited at the door of the boss where the buck stops, Tom Menino?
Absolutely.
I was sort of surprised that there was a one-word answer there, because I think most of the candidates, at least yesterday and from what we've heard in other interviews and forums, have gone out of their way to sort of dance around the Menino issue, because I think despite what they say, and they all say he's not going to pick a candidate, he's not going to endorse anybody, that having the wink from Tom Menino could ultimately be the difference maker.
But you just said don't ask about the mayor. The Meninoism was, you know, fix the sidewalks, but don't ask. Don't ask what?
Don't ask where the power and the profits and the real direction of the city is going. And Tom Menino is famous for not wanting to engage on the vision questions. I mean, I would say there's a big, just framing this whole contest, there's a kind of fraud going on here. To me, the question, it came up a number of times yesterday, indirectly, but the question before the city is, why can't we have real schools? And the answer is that we don't want to talk about the development game and the tax base of the city. I mean, this is a rich city, as somebody said yesterday, and it's going to get richer. I mean, we're in a wonderful position. We're centered in the medical and especially the education industries. It's a wonderful place to live. And, you know, luxury housing is going up, you know, all over the place. But is this the measure of our happiness, of where we want to go? I mean, one of the big Menino-isms that has settled on the city is that the metric of our happiness, the metric of our prosperity, is the number of construction cranes that we can see anywhere in town. And it's not a good metric. Shirley Kressel uses that line. But you know, the more interesting thing comes from Rob Consalvo, David Scharfenberg, if I can mention, a WBUR reporter and a good one, had a piece quoting Consalvo saying, basically, the city's at its highest pinnacle in history, right? We've got cranes all over the city dotting the skyline. So I'm confused as to what's so bad about the BRA. Well, there's a lot bad about the BRA, especially when we can't seem to finance a standard school system.
By the way, on the BRA front, that was one of the areas where I think there was a populist bent in a lot of the candidates who went out of their way to say either too much secrecy,
yes,
not doing the right things on development. So let me just pose a question.
I taught it up, Jim. Not that many said there's too much secrecy. Bill Walczak did. Most of the candidates, as Christine Poff in Jamaica Plain said to me, they don't want to say anything bad about the BRA because they want to capture it. The BRA for a mayor is something like the CIA for a president. It's his plaything. And he gets to, you know, he gets to do all sorts of things. Tom Menino gets to put his Hubway bike thing is located in the BRA. But it's a place where it's beyond review. It's beyond court review. It's beyond popular review, it's beyond city council review, it's beyond journalistic review. Nobody knows the deals, these 121A tax agreements, that the BRA is in the business of handing out.
But it's pretty clear to me the reason that candidates, I'm not defending it, I'm trying to explain it, don't go as far as you'd like to go them on the BRA is because of the follow-up question, which most of them don't want to answer, is, well, it is Tom Menino's BRA, so if it's malfunctioning, is it Tom Menino's fault? And as we learned from yesterday, most don't want to criticize them. Our number is 877-301-8970. Whether you listened or not yesterday, what kind of mayor are you looking for Boston? And do you think there's a populist in this field of, well, there are 12 candidates, even though the 12th who didn't show up yesterday has shown up at virtually nothing.
Christopher Lyon, you just mentioned the tax base in Boston. Now, are you saying that the taxes should be raised in Boston? I mean, they're pretty high in the Back Bay and all that. Should they be raised?
Incredibly high on homeowners in the Back Bay.
Okay, they're pretty cheap in other parts of the city, Hyde Park, Jamaica, well, not Jamaica Plain, that's gone up, but Rosendale, Roxbury, Dorchester. They're not hugely. That's one of the reasons people like to move back to Boston, especially after they've retired, because the taxes in a lot of the neighborhoods are not that high. Should they be higher?
Well, I'm not raising anybody's tax bill, but the fact is the city is a hot property. Housing values have not fallen really in much of any part of this city.
Nope.
It's a terrifically hot development spot. People should be paying top dollar, and they should be paying their fair share of a community's burdens for the privilege of developing and living and moving here. So that would mean, sure, that the city has the whip hand on these deals, and it's not using it. We don't know, and again, we don't know, and we don't test the assessments and the values that are being given away here. But the Herald, to give the Herald credit, ran a long series of articles on these deals, these 121As, 12
yes.
parts, and
yes.
it was good. And it basically said what Shirley Kressel says, which is that the development deals are eating away at the base of the
Tell
city.
Us who Shirley Kressel is, who's been around
she
forever.
She should be on your show.
She's great.
A remarkable white-haired lady with a time on her hands to go to every single BRA meeting and find every little small piece of information you can about her. She reminds me of Jane Jacobs. She's a total urban child, like Jane Jacobs, came from Canada originally, but she knows the city like the back of her hand, and she watches all these deals. And basically what she says is that these tax breaks are the death warrant of the city, partly because, you know, they live in a secret world behind the curtain, but also that we're not looking at the overall needs. Jim, how many times do you ask where you're going to get the money for the schools or for a longer day or whatever? It's a perfectly good question, but the answer is we can afford it. Walczak said, I mean, we don't need casinos to, you know, make ends meet around here. This is a very, very prosperous city. There's not a better place to be a city country.
There's another answer, by the way. Let me just give out the number if I can. 877-301-8970. Again, what kind of mayor you're looking for? Do you see a populist in this field? 877-301-8970. You know what I didn't hear yesterday at all, and I hadn't thought about it much until you said it, talked about where does the money come from? As of a handful of years ago, more than 50% of the property in Boston was occupied by nonprofit organizations,
sure, churches and schools,
universities. And universities wildly rich, and as you know, they're exempt from property
right.
taxes. They negotiate these pilot payments in lieu of taxes, which are always exponentially smaller than what their tax would be if they paid an actual tax. It's amazing that nobody went at that set of institutions were, you know, you go where, who's the, Al Capone, who said, I rob banks because that's where the money is. Well, where the money is in a lot of these huge private universities.
Sure. Well, and again, when you're hot, and the city is hot, it ought to be driving much harder bargains and dealing for the public interest of the whole community. I mean, that was another thing I thought was just totally, I won't say totally, missing in most of the voices we heard yesterday, which was just a sense of the sort of the playground, street level reality of the neighborhoods that we know and love in this city. The sense of plain people. Yes, there are a number of minority candidates, but I didn't feel there was one minority candidate that really spoke for a minority community that would be there for poor people of color or Hispanic or language difference. Maybe Felix Arroyo was the exception. He said, and I was proud of him, we've got to break the cycle of poverty.
Well, also, Charles Yancey spoke a lot in his last interview.
I think he's not raising a lot of money, Charles Yancey.
I understand, but he is one of the 11 candidates.
But let me ask you, Bill Walczak,
I think, is another model.
Yep.
His career in...
built the Codman Square Health Center.
The Codman Square Health Center is his monument so far. But as he would tell you, it was fundamentally a treatment of a premise that disease... the disease is poverty, and the challenge was to build a dense, self-starting network of citizens who could link healthcare and education in an experimental way and build something for people who really need it. And that neighborhood was, as you know, in flames when he moved in there 35 years ago.
It's much better now. The whole city is much better now.
The whole city is.
But
and
let me
yet
ask
the city
you something.
Is, there is. There are needy people, there are good people being. I won't say driven from the city, but being forced out by higher rents. There are a lot of poor people's needs in the city yet to be addressed with money, and especially with good school opportunity and good community health care opportunity. That's, to me, the elephant in the room is this separation of the downtown development prosperity, the crane, so to speak, that process and the what you would say are the ordinary social needs of a place we love.
But did you see anyone or hear anyone, I should say, yesterday, given the fact that all of them except for John Conley, who declared, of course, for mayor before we knew that Tom Menino was not running again, besides John Conley, who seems to have what it takes to, after the election, tackle some of these issues, that has the brains, that has the chutzpah, that has the political skills to tackle these things?
I think Bill Walczak has a proven record, and he's always been good on any issue. When I was running for mayor 20 years ago, I said, Bill, you should be running.
You've mentioned Walczak about 11 times. Let me just say, I thought as on whole, I sensed the same kind of cautiousness you did. The only person that's, well, you have too. I've run in a multi-person field for office, city council in Cambridge.
Cleaned up.
And in all seriousness, there were 24 candidates. 50% plus didn't deserve to, I mean, completely clueless. I didn't think there was anybody in this whole group yesterday who didn't have a brain, didn't have some ideas. This was pretty competent field. My major criticism was where you started, was there was an excess of caution, I thought. And I think that's a function of the
blandness.
Fact this is a slow starting campaign.
Niceness. But I didn't feel this fire in any of this kind of, but let me put in a word for somebody else who keeps surprising me. That's Rob Consalvo. He is Tom Menino with the gift of speech, and he's good. I love that. You know, I'm a geek, and there's no sort of crazy plan, including rubber sidewalks, that he wouldn't consider. And he loves that. There's enthusiasm, energy. Two kids in the public school system, a third on the way. I think he is a community guy. Never missed a meeting in his life. I've been getting emails from him forever, you know, three a week or whatever. But to me, he has energy, but he doesn't, again, I just wish we could lay that development issue out. That's the elephant in the room, and nobody's really saying, of course, that's the central issue.
We have a correction here.
What's that?
I suppose it was Willie Sutton.
It was not Al Capone. Yeah. You're right.
Thank you, Mark.
I said Billy Sutton before
he ran for mayor, I think, when you ran. Our number is 877-301-8970. Let's take a couple of calls. What are you looking for in a mayor? If you heard yesterday's cast of 11, you can feel free to critique them. Robert, you're in JP. You're on with Christopher Lydon on open mic. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent. Thanks for the call.
Great conversation. Chris, you said something earlier that I want to ask you about. It seemed that you were suggesting that the ills of the Boston public schools are predominantly financial. Is that where you're heading?
No, but I wouldn't say primarily. There are multiple and diverse problems in the Boston public schools, and my kids all went there. But money would help.
Well, you know, the schools are funded. I mean, look at it, it's almost $1 billion to educate 55,000 kids. You ought to be able to do it for that.
I did the math yesterday. It comes at, 15,000 per kid, roughly.
There's a lot of bureaucracy in the Boston public schools.
Yeah, much too much. Go ahead, Robert.
And in addition, though, one of the things that we underestimate is the extent to which the Boston public schools are a political body. And even though there's an appointed school committee, nonetheless, they're still answering to a number of different constituencies. The community, the teachers' union, the parents, to some extent the kids and the needs of the kids and the demands of the educational community. But when you look at how much better charter schools are doing at educating the neediest of our kids,
but they're not,
they're
Robert.
Primarily, well, they are that the neediest, the toughest kids. The studies show they do better on. And the real reason is because they focus on kids. They focus on education. Boston Public Schools focuses on education. This was, in a sense, John Connolly's point. He's, it's not that there are a lot of incompetent individuals up there. It's that the system is incompetent.
Yeah.
And I think John Connolly may be the only guy willing to focus on it and to take on that problem.
I think you're right. I happen to think you're right about John Connolly. He's a total school wonk. When he was still in high school or college, he came and interviewed me about my own experience. I mean, that was my first introduction to John Connolly. He cares. His kids are there. He watches very, very carefully.
Former teacher, too, didn't he?
Yeah. No, I think he's deeply serious about it.
Robert, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
The other obvious corollary to the Boston schools improving is that you wouldn't have the middle class flight. And, you have a
including
million...
Including my middle daughter and her two kids.
Yeah,
and husband.
I left to get away from the schools after my niece and nephew had a difficult time there. And you realize you almost have to be a full-time school watcher to get your kids through the Boston public schools. And, it seems to me if they made more of an effort to keep those middle class parents that flee. I mean, and what are you going to do if your kid is not getting into Boston Latin?
What if a mayoral candidate simply said, look, less than 60,000 kids in this system, they're more like 1 million in New York, perfect experiment in the educational capital of the world. We are going to have a bang up, terrific school system. I promise you, however you want to measure it in terms of choice and desirability of places, test scores, staying in school, colleges, jobs, et cetera. I mean, what if that were the place? Test me on that promise that in this one, where the Horace Mann
and promise invented, that? Didn't he promise he was going to, the school's going to be better when he left than when he got
who?
In? Tom Menino.
No.
Wait,
I had to
what
beat him over the head
made...
about the school issues. And I think, I didn't get that many votes, but I did force that issue onto the table. He did get a very professional superintendent, Tom Payzant.
He did say in one of his State of the City speeches, judge me by the quality of the city's schools.
And most
X number of
our
years.
Schools and school performance is substandard.
You said a minute ago you thought in response to that caller, the charter schools were not the answer. Marjorie thinks they are.
I do.
I don't think they're the
Why
answer.
Why is that?
I mean, I think we've got to have variety and choice, and I think a few, private or independently run alternatives are good. On the other hand, first of all, the overall record of performance in the charter schools nationally is not spectacular. And moreover, it's a kind of privatization. It's sort of like, farming out your kids, your parenting, I think it's the community's responsibility to educate its young.
But when you go into some of these charter schools, and this is where I disagree with you, the kids that are teaching there, they went to Yale, they went to Harvard, they're 24, they're working from 7 o'clock in the morning till 7 o'clock at night. They burn out. But for that time that they're there, the excitement level and the excitement of the students and the one-to-one attention these kids get, you can't compare it to what you see in a school with one teacher and 24 kids and a teacher that may not.
You know, one of the problems is, you and I have had this discussion for about 15 years. I mentioned to you, there was a guy who, Gary Bellow, who was at Harvard Law School, who created a model legal services program office when I was in, I think it was in JP, when I was the head of the legal services union. And I loved Gary. But what I always say to him, it was a variation on a charter school. What I would always say is, Gary, as successful as your experiment has been, take over an existing legal services office, like the one I worked in the South Bronx. Don't create one brand new. Just like take over a school that's troubled in Boston, fix that school. Because the reality is the existing schools in very limited numbers. That's where this charter movement, I think, could make a far greater impact.
Well, the in-district charters have had some great success, and those are much more run by the city and with the same with some of the different rules for the union and stuff like that.
Consider charter schools to be public schools.
Well, they are public schools.
But I think the biggest successes are the ones that are the pilot schools, in my view, Linda Nathan at the Arts Academy. There's a genius manager of a public institution. She was autonomous, essentially. She had fundamentally harmonious, handpicked staff, and she was in the corridor. Her kids call her mom, you know, every day of the week.
And by the way, the union, I should say, for whatever it's worth, I've spoken
inside the system
to a former president
in the North End, another one with a great
but
principal.
She also, Linda Nathan, without going to, because most people don't know who we're talking about, if you spoke, which I did, to the head of the teachers union, how do you feel about Linda Nathan? They raved about her. So the reality is principals who are creative and doing extraordinary things can also cross that divide. Let's take a call or two, Chris, if we can.
Please.
Bruce, you're in Mission Hill. You're on with Chris Lydon. We're talking about the field of mayoral candidates. Go.
Yes. Good afternoon, everyone.
Hi.
A great show. Chris, I would want to ask you what your opinion is, and the panel as well, on Charlotte Golar Richie. It seems as though she hasn't resonated with you, but I'm curious to know how you feel about her and her qualifications.
Her qualifications include wonderful service on the 10 o'clock news at WGBH, which was mentioned yesterday.
Oh, it's the Chiron operator when she was
exactly.
a lot younger.
And she
That's
was
right.
a promising kid then and a marvelous woman today. I didn't think she said anything interesting yesterday, Bruce. I didn't think she came down hard or edgily on any of the big questions.
Bruce, what do you think of her?
Well, I really appreciate her. I think her work says a lot to her abilities to run a major city, and I think people should ask that question. We haven't been in Boston in my time here really accustomed to challenges for the mayoral seat. And, you know, how now do we go about speaking to the entire city, we being the candidates, I should say, without, you know, offending someone? And as they say, how do you get your head out of the lion's mouth?
But did she offend anybody or come near it yesterday, Bruce? I mean, she's got an extraordinary record from the Peace Corps on. She's a wonderful person. But I didn't feel any strong direction yesterday.
Well, you know, and again, how strong can any candidate be over the breadth of the subject matter that you're talking about? Again, without sounding particularly the candidates of color, if you will, without having people set the alarms that we're going to City Hall is going to be changed into whatever you fill in the metaphor. So I think everybody is cautious except for our male candidates, and I, again, as you were pointing out, I think Bill Walczak has that kind of balance. But as well, in terms of the overall administration with the Chamber of Commerce feeling comfortable with the candidate, I think she's had the contact in those camps.
But is that what we need, especially for the minority community, Bruce?
Oh,
I mean, I'm thinking of the voice of Bruce Wall. Bruce Wall is up in arms all the time on the radio and otherwise about the safety of black young people in Mattapan and Dorchester.
He's been a great crusader.
But I didn't hear even a hint of the anxiety, the concern, the urgency of that issue from any of the candidates yesterday.
Hey, Bruce, thank you for the call. We got to move. Hey, so Chris, wrap this up. Tell us the two things you most want to hear from candidates up through September 24th, which is the runoff, which you didn't hear yesterday and haven't heard up to date. What are the two things?
The voice I'd love to hear on Boston Public Radio is Shirley Kressel. Just call her up. She lives there.
We'll deal with her. She's not running for mayor. How about the 11 candidates?
The 11 candidates, 12. I'd love to say, look, it's evident everywhere. We restaurants, ballparks, skyscrapers, luxury housing. This city is doing incredibly well. How about spreading it around? How about the whole family taking part in a coming golden age of this town? We shouldn't still be, you know, questioning whether we can afford to educate our children in public institutions. I mean, the Boston Public School is the oldest public school in this country. Horace Mann, you know, the public schools of the country were built on Boston's example. I think that's where we still should be focusing, and not nickel and diming. Can we afford it? No, let's get real with the developers and ask them to pay their way to the whole town.
You know, if your campaign had continued just a few extra days, you would have won. History would have been different.
Can you imagine?
Just another week.
I'd be in my 11th, you know, term. We'd all be fat and happy.
Christopher Lydon.
Hey, Chris, you know, we never say a week in advance what we're going to do.
Let's do it.
However, I am so excited about what we're talking about, and we want all of our listeners to go do something so they can participate. What are we talking about next
Thursday? We're talking about 20 Feet from Stardom, and apparently you had the same reaction. I can't get it out of my mind.
Nor can I.
I said, no, that's the greatest movie I've ever seen.
One of the best.
It's the greatest thing I've ever seen. And I want to talk about the humanism, the power, the suffering, the glory, the aspiration, the reality of those 5, 6, 7 women.
Backup singers. 20 feet from the...
For the Rolling Stones and Ray Charles and...
And Sting and... By the way, in 20 Feet from Stardom means literally that, 20 feet behind the star. I can't wait. I love the movie.
Oh, man. I want to see it three times between now and next week.
Okay. Great to see you. We'll see you next Thursday. And by the way, see the movie, 20 Feet from Stardom. It is terrific.
Christopher Lydon is the man behind RadioOpenSource.org. He joins us every Thursday at 1 o'clock, and next week at 1 o'clock, we will be talking about 20 Feet from Stardom. It's playing right now in the city. You can see it, too, and join our discussion. When we come back, Karen Miller joins us. Does she know something about education and our school system that the mayoral candidates do not? That conversation is next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Whitey Bulger trial is a tangle of informants and hitmen, FBI agents, and innocent bystanders. Visit our website at WGBHnews.org, where you can follow live trial updates from reporters Philip Martin and Adam Riley, plus see our Bulger timeline and an outline of who's who in the proceedings. That's all online at WGBHnews.org.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Tanglewood, presenting Yo-Yo Ma with the BSO, led by Charles Dutoit in music by Dvorak and Stravinsky, Sunday, August 4th. More information available online at tanglewood.org. And pioneers of television, no form of TV keeps us laughing quite like the sitcom, but within the jokes lie deft social commentaries. Don't miss Pioneers of Television, sitcoms, Thursday at 9 on WGBH2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And you know, we spent much of yesterday, we made that clear, talking about the city's schools with the 11 who would be Boston's next mayor. And while there were plenty of ideas, none of them suggested the 2013 model was a throwback to the industrial age. Well, a former Yahoo VP said just that and has ideas about how to fix things. He spoke to Kara Miller of GBH's Innovation Hub. She will now speak to us. Hello, Kara.
Hi. You know, let's actually start with a little piece. This guy's name is Seth Godin. A lot of people out there know him. He built this tiny marketing firm, sold it to Yahoo for $30 million, and then he became a best-selling author. And basically, he argues that you have to sort of break outside the box. And what he's really concerned about is that our schools are training an army of people for the kinds of jobs that existed 100 years
ago. Yeah, that was depressing to read this, let me tell you.
I heard Christopher Lydon talking about Horace Mann, and it's interesting because Seth Godin is really interested in Horace Mann from Massachusetts, superintendent of schools in Massachusetts, yep. who basically said, we really need schools, and there's a bunch of reasons for them, but here are a few. We want to train people to be prompt, to be obedient. I mean, what did they want to train them for? Well, factory work. I mean, yeah. it was really important. We had a lot of new immigrants. People needed to learn a certain amount of English. They had to learn how to take orders really well. And now the economy has totally shifted, and we're still training people exactly the same way. So let's just listen to a little bit of Seth Godin saying that public school exists to train children, essentially to work in factories.
If you think school is to train people to go work in a factory, which is why we invented it. School's only 150 years old, public school. If you think that's what it's for, then it's doing a pretty good job. But if you think school is for teaching kids resilience and problem solving and initiative and leadership, then school is failing on all fronts.
I mean, so that's the question. You know, have we moved into a new era? Are we doing a good job of training people?
Well, he goes on to trash higher education as well, which is very depressing news for people that are like up to their eye teeth in debt, sending all their kids to college. You wasted your time. You shouldn't even have gone. So what should we be doing, according to Seth?
So, I mean, I think he would say is that what's important is not the piece of paper. He's really against standardized testing,
yep.
which there's different schools of thought on this. The standardized test, I was interested to learn, only was invented 99 years ago, 1914. And the idea was it was World War I. We had a lot of immigrants, and we needed to really get people in the labor force, potentially in the military quickly. And it was invented to test literally lower level thinking. That was the explicit reason of it, just to kind of sort of make sure that you pass the bar. And now it's become the thing, as you know, if you have kids in school, that drives school.
Right.
I have talked to people who have said, you know, my spouse is a teacher, and all they do in that class all year is prepare for that test.
Teach her the test.
And she wishes that she could do really creative things and take kids out on field trips and do lab kind of stuff if it's science. And we can't do it. I mean, all we're doing is measuring kids by that test. And I think it's a really interesting question. I'm interested in what, you know, listeners think. What do they see in schools? What do they see with their kids?
Let's give the number, 877-301-8970. What are the reforms you'd make? It's sort of a continuation of our discussion with Christopher Lydon, now with Carrie Miller. What do you see in your kids' school, or if you just got out recently yourself, what are the reforms you would do? Like, for standardized testing is a good starting point. I will make Marjorie's argument. I can't believe she's made it already. Standardized testing came back big into the Massachusetts school system as part of the education reform in the mid-1990s, and I hated it. But the reason they did it, in fairness to the other side of this argument, was a ton of people were falling through the cracks. There wasn't a serious effort made to ensure that everybody was up to speed. So they took, in my opinion, the easy road, the easiest road being standardized testing. And it does, we may disagree, Marjorie, you and I, it does suppress creativity to a frightening degree because they do teach you the test. The way kids are judged and, more importantly, in many cases, the way teachers are judged by how well their kids do in these standardized tests.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think there's clearly an argument for standardized testing, which is you don't want kids graduating from high school who can't read. And part of the thing—
Which was a big problem.
Which was a problem. And so people say, hey, look, shouldn't you be able to answer some basic questions? Here are the basic questions. Go answer them. So, I mean, I completely see the reason for standardized testing.
But it can't be the end-all, be-all. And that's
what
it's become.
And that's
in many
what
settings.
It's become. And it's amazing to me. I think I was a lot more pro-standardized testing before I started talking to deans at colleges who said people cannot think creatively. You know, they have not, they've learned science and math in a kind of prescriptive way. They know how to sort of spit stuff back to you. But if you start saying to them, okay, take it out into the real world. Let's take it away from the numbers and take it away from the textbook. Do you really, really understand this principle of physics? So often, they don't. They don't know
where
it comes from.
Well, because memorization is also, right. And that's one of the things the guy you interviewed.
Yeah, he doesn't want to memorize anything.
But that is
memorizing is totally worthless. And he also has this other great idea. Well, I'm not sure if memorizing is totally worthless. I think more of us should memorize poetry, actually. But that's just me. But the idea that you should have these lectures from the world's top thinkers, I think that is a great idea, that you can get so much information and education online by listening to geniuses talk about their selective fields. That is a great point.
Well, this ties back to a conversation we had a while back about Sal Khan, who founded Khan Academy.
Right.
And basically what Seth Godin thinks we should be doing is kids should spend their evenings listening to really smart people give lectures about all sorts of things and then go into school and do very hands-on kind of things. So they already did the sitting back and the listening.
Right.
Then you explore it, right? Then you have the labs, then you go out into the real world.
You, well, and you do
check
homework
out the
salamanders, during the day, he believes too, not
yep,
at home. Right.
Yep, you do homework at during the day and the teacher comes around and says, you seem to be having problems
totally
with this
right.
kind of problem. Instead of, you know, you're sitting in your kitchen and your parents trying to help you and you can't get along. I mean,
well, you know, you haven't had that experience yet because you have a young kid. Marjorie and I, there's nothing more frustrating than having a bright kid, which we both have, who is struggling with homework on something you know nothing about and having no resource.
I was like
no
lost
place.
After third grade.
No,
I mean, the math
no, but I'm serious.
Was beyond me.
But beyond math, almost anything. I mean, other than writing, for example, where obviously someone like you can help, the reality is the notion that it isn't done in school where the experts are who can help is insane.
Well, and then as Sal Khan said, what happens is, okay, so you try to help your kid with their worksheet or whatever. They go in, they get an 85 on it. Okay, that's pretty good. And then they move on to the next thing. Well, you know, Sal Khan said, if you had built 85% of a foundation, would you feel good about putting the first floor on it? Then you built 85% of a first floor. That's by the time you get to the second floor, you're falling down into the basement, right? And so what happens is kids learn 85% of something. Then they go to learn something 3 years later, and you realize, oh, they really never learned percentages that
yeah.
well. But they learned 85% of it. So, you know, so they were sort of shuttled along to the next thing. You can learn 75% of something and be shuttled along to the next
That's
thing.
That's right. Or 60%.
Exactly.
Even worse.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think this is a really interesting question that Seth Godin brings up. And the question is, how do you change schools? He thinks, really, we saw yesterday thousands of people striking because they wanted better pay at fast food restaurants.
Right.
Right? So how do you train people for jobs that pay well, that are creative, that are not these kind of repetitive industrial sort of jobs? So here's another little clip of Seth Godin talking about a new economy that he thinks we are not preparing people for.
We have this new economy, I call it the connection economy, where value is not created by mass production, but value is created by being weird, by going to the edges, by innovating. Value is created by connecting with people, and the only thing anyone wants to actively connect to is something interesting.
I mean, yeah.
So obvious, it's ridiculous, but it's a fine
okay.
point.
Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What do you think about Seth Godin's ideas? Do you think that your children's education, your own education, has been totally worthless, which is essentially what he's saying, not to mention your college education or your kids' college education as well? Let's go to Art from Worcester. Hi, Art from Worcester. What do you think?
Yeah, well, we need to move away again from this 19th century idea. We're all currently a product of that. And get into career tracks that emphasize creativity and innovation. The world is changing exponentially. And we need to have children be able to learn on their own, but have a massive amount of information at their fingertips. I'm reminded of an experiment that was done with a tribe in Africa that has never seen a computer, never heard of one. They've parachuted in about 30 laptops, and within the first day, someone figured out how to turn it on. And at the end of two years, they were doing nuclear physics. And it's just because the human adaptability and creativity is allowed to go wherever it wants. We have that ability now. The rules and regulations are out the window. We have the cloud to look to for our future education. And we need to be able to step back, give our kids a chance to establish themselves and encourage them, support them, but not put roadblocks in their way. And I think there's people like, of course, Rick Kurzweil and others who study the future, who predict the kind of growth and world that we're coming to, are really right on about we have to start thinking exponentially and not linearly.
Art, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. I mean, I think the threshold, which we should all agree upon before we get yelled at by somebody, there's certain basics everybody's got to know. But once you reach that plateau,
wonder why there are certain basics. I am lousy in math. I mean, I can add, I can subtract. That's about it. Why do I need to learn Algebra 2. Why do I need to learn calculus? I've never used it. I was hopeless at math as a little girl. I'm always going to be hopeless at math. Why do I have to spend my time struggling through this? That's the big debate in colleges. Should you have to take a math in college? Should you have to take a science in college? You know, they had physics for poets when I was in college because I was never going to learn any principles from physics. This was to dumb it down for people like me. But why do I need to learn that?
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's a really interesting question because Seth Godin actually says we spend millions of dollars trying to transmit to millions of kids trigonometry. And
why?
Most of them will never,
exactly,
ever use it. Now, I don't know if that means we shouldn't use – I mean, I'm trying to wrap my mind around if we have an educational system that's not working. That's pretty clear to me. It's not working,
not working
very well. How do you get to something better? I mean, he notes that 58% of people, after they leave – school, never, ever again read a book for pleasure. So how well...
58%?
Yeah. So how well have we done saying to people, this is what's important? He actually talks, I have to get this in here, about a big study of high school students, and they were asked, what do you want to be when you grow up? And girls were asked. The choices were the chief of a major company like General Motors, a Navy SEAL, a U.S. senator, the president of a great university like Harvard or Yale, the personal assistant to a very famous singer or movie star.
I know what they say.
There
know,
you
of
go.
43.4%
says the personal assistant to a very famous music, famous singer or movie star. Now, keep in mind, they're not saying they want to be a famous movie star or singer, just their assistant. So how well have we done at saying, here is what is really important in life, and how well have we done at saying, here's what's really interesting, the stuff that's going on in Hollywood, even if all you are is a hanger-on.
What percentage is that?
43%.
I'd do that in 2 seconds.
There you
I'm
go.
Part of the.
So you'd leave your job here
exactly,
right now.
Like in 2 seconds.
Who would you like to be the personal
Beyonce,
assistant?
Beyonce, I would like. If I could hang out with Jay-Z and Beyonce. We're talking to Kara Miller, obviously, at the Innovation Hub, and she interviewed this guy, Seth Godin, former vice president of Yahoo, who has a lot of. They aren't really revolutionary. They are common sense to me, but about how you essentially bring the education system out of another century. You know, one thing before we get back to the Coles, we used to interview fairly regularly on our former radio life, David Driscoll, who was the commissioner of education.
Oh, yes.
And while he's talking about content, one of the things Driscoll would talk to us all about was the school day that was created when we were an agrarian society.
Right, that's right.
And essentially, we have the exactly. We have the same year and same school
that's
day
right.
as we did when kids were leaving class to
for
go
the crops.
Out to do the crops. I mean, and you know, people laugh at this, but it is totally true. We're locked in another century.
Yeah,
let's go back to the Coles.
Kids are all doing the crops. That's what they're doing, this
yeah,
August.
Different kind of crops.
Oh, Liz in Boston. Hi, Liz.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm a public educator, and I have been for about 15 years.
Yep.
And I am tiring of people from outside of my field telling me what I'm doing wrong, what's wrong with what's going on in my classroom. I wish sometimes that folks who are in the classroom regularly could have as loud of a voice as someone like the gentleman that was interviewed.
What do you think, Liz? What do you think should be going on?
Well, first of all, people need to come in and see what's happening in schools. Everything that I'm hearing is described is not what happens in many of the classrooms that I visit or in my own. We're studying Shakespeare. I'm not teaching kids how to fill in bubbles. I'm doing things that will help to prepare them for things like the MCAS, but it's certainly not my goal. And I think a lot of teachers probably do and feel the same. I just wish we had a platform upon which we could speak to the public from.
Well, first of all,
but you know
Liz,
something, you know something, Liz? You know something, Liz? I think that great teachers were obvious when I was in school a million years ago. Great teachers were obvious with my own children. I saw these great teachers who were incredibly creative, who were not teaching the test, who did brilliant stuff. And then I saw poor teachers that I wish had been fired and weren't there at all. So I think a lot of people do appreciate what goes on parents because they see it in their own kids and their own kids' excitement about learning from a really great teacher, which you probably are.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I think, too, in terms of usefulness of things that kids are learning, maybe they won't ever use, you know, what they've learned from Shakespeare, but they've learned to read something beautiful and appreciate something
totally
very important. And I think that is something that's far more important than getting a good job.
Liz, how about
Liz?
Really
Liz, one last thing. How about trigonometry? Why do we need trigonometry?
I teach English. I don't even know what
okay.
that is.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Liz, thanks for a great call. We appreciate it.
I think she makes a good point about learning. You know, we were talking about trigonometry. I mean, certainly something like the iPhone is a triumph of design, mathematics, engineering, right? You can't really make that unless you understand a whole bunch of things that come together. And I mean, in some senses, it really doesn't make sense that we have these separate classes. I was talking to somebody, can't remember who, about time zones and about teaching people about time zones. Oh, it was Bob C., our morning anchor. And he was talking about the idea of teaching people about time zones. Well, that's a math problem, but it's a geography issue. It's historical. Why were time zones ever introduced? You know, what do they do? What's the purpose? I feel like a lot of things that we do have intersections, but we create very artificial. Okay, yeah. Well, the bell has rung. Math is over. Now you're on to science. I mean, that's what happens, right? You go down the hall and you're in a totally different world where no connection will be made between the thing you just did.
Well, yeah, in defense, since none of the three of us have any idea why we're teaching trigonometry, let me posit a notion, is that two of the areas in which we're doing worse in this country in terms of our international competition is math and science. And just like you and I, Marjorie, I know would agree, and Carrie, you might
you're
too,
good at math,
that
though.
The more sophisticated our understanding of literature, for example, is when you get out of high school, the more better able you are to communicate.
Right.
Well, maybe the theory is the more sophisticated your understanding of higher levels of mathematics are, the more likely it is you'll pursue something in math or science, which yes. obviously is going to help us fill this huge gap between us and the rest of the world.
But I would argue that by the time you're 15 or 14, maybe even younger, you know if you have any aptitude in math or not. And that's what I'm saying.
Oh, you're saying if somebody just doesn't get it, should they be forced to? Well,
exactly.
That's a very good point.
I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Viziani from Malden. I probably botched that. I'm sorry. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you for taking my call. Right now, I am a senior at Northeastern University, and I'm training to take my GRE.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think that I don't understand now, with all those studies being done, why we need to take standardized tests, because I just feel that's not fair. Because it's kind of test what do you know, but doesn't test the background of the person. Because one person that is rich and went to good schools and has like a 5 or 3 hours a day to study is going to have a very different score from someone that could do the same job if was allowed in a grad school, but only had 2 hours to study or has kids or needs to work full-time to, you know, have a living. So I think that those standardized tests, they are very unfair and does not truly test what you really know or not.
And
so
it doesn't test if you can think, Viziani, which I am totally with you, and thank you very much
Viziani
for the call.
It sounds like Viziani is not excited about taking the GREs, exactly how I felt about the GREs. Now, I have to say, one thing about standardized tests, and SATs bear this out, is that the scores you get tend to correlate a lot more closely with your household income than they do with how you're going to do in college.
Well, one of the best shows we ever did, Marjorie and I did, was off a story in the New York Times which said on the essay portion of the SAT, which I thought was a great addition because it required people to think as opposed to just fill in a box, the longer you're – it was an MIT study.
Yes.
There was
it.
A direct correlation between the length of the essay, no matter what the content was, and the grade. Even if it was gibberish, if it was long. Do you remember who called us immediately after? A good friend of yours who has a radio show in Boston? Matty Siegel heard the radio show, told his daughter, who was about to take the SAT, just keep writing. And which sort
she's
of undercuts the whole notion.
Well, it's the kind of thing that if you have a tutor, right? If you have a tutor for the SATs, they know it. I mean, that's the kind of thing that separates the high-income people from the low-income people. And it's interesting to go back to Liz's call. I don't think she said where she teaches, but I also worry that there's a big gap in terms of creativity and ability to really bring in different things outside the classroom in high income places versus low income.
Hey, Kara Miller, when are we going to hear from you and Seth Godin? When's that happening?
This Saturday.
You knew it right away.
Yeah, yep. And tonight is the conversation about distraction with Sherry Turkle,
Nicholas
Carr, and Clifford Nass. It's been a very, very popular show.
Down with multitasking.
Yeah.
9 o'clock tonight, 10 o'clock Saturday morning. Kara Miller, Kara, it's great to see you. We'll see
you
next week.
Good to see you.
Tonight at 7 o'clock, by the way, a programming note on Greater Boston, Jared Bowen is hosting. He interviews Police Commissioner Ed Davis. Please tune in for that, and thank you for tuning in. to us today. And by the way, I'm told if you have questions for Ed Davis, you go to WGBHnews.org.
Correct.
And somewhere on there you'll find a way you can get questions to them. Tomorrow's our Friday news quiz. The Globe's Alex Beam against the Boston Herald's Peter Gilzinis. That should be a smackdown if there ever was one. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan.
It was great having you here today. And by the way, those mayoral interviews, if you want to check them out, are all at WGBHnews.org too. We'll see you tomorrow at noon. Bye.